I'm not that sure.
Well,
okay. Let's see how it does. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Is it sacrilegious to put this on?
You can put it wherever you want to.
Stop it.
Hey, everyone. You're nasty. Hi, everyone. I'm Jeffrey, and I'm a crystal meth addict. I'm so grateful to be here. My intention was that I was going to be the plus one, and that changed Thursday night when Marvin and Chris got a hold of me going into... Chris and I were going to go see Sweeney Todd. And Chris looked at me like I had just killed the puppy. And I was like, what's going on? You know, he's getting these texts, and he's like, the main speaker can't be there. Would you be willing to step in? And I was like, no. I thought, because my head, first of all, I thought that Chris had only gotten one ticket to Sweeney Todd. And I was pissed. So, and then he showed me the text, and you know, everything in me would say no, but, you know, but of course I was like, yes, please text them back. Yes. Because that is what I've learned here in recovery, is I just say yes today to the right things, And, I was so excited to come here. I came to this convention. I'm still trying to figure out if it was 10 or 11 years ago. I came with a boyfriend. I was like, where is he? Oh, no, he's okay. No, I'll get into that. Anyways, I am so grateful. If I say anything, is that I'm so grateful to Crystal Meth Anonymous. It really, really saved my life. It is a language that I speak, and here's the truth. I mean, here, this is just my truth today, is that I loved doing crystal meth. I loved it. I hated the consequences, and they inevitably came worse and worse and worse. And so, I'll just qualify quickly on that, is that, I started doing crystal meth at 13. My twin brother and I, he came home, he was like, Jeffrey, you gotta try this. And I was like, okay. And it was the most perfect day. That feeling of not feeling a part of my family. I was tall. I was beautiful. I was smart. I was desirable. You know, I had nothing but possibilities. And 2 days later, when I came down, I was like, I gotta do this again. How do I get this? And so... and it was the only moment that my twin brother and I weren't fighting. So I remember this. I remember the day. I remember how it felt. And I chased it. I chased that feeling for 10 years. You know, rough, delusional. So, like I said, just a part of the qualification is that, just so you know where I come from, is that I grew up in Orange County, California, which is about 60, 70 miles south of Los Angeles. We lived between two Marine bases. And so I was a very precocious child, and throwing crystal meth, I was out in the orange groves a lot looking for rides. And and, you know, as a 13-year-old, you know, I'm not doing it every day. No, I'm not doing it every weekend. But it was that thing I was always chasing. So being an addict alcoholic, when I drink, I'm done with the booze pretty quickly. And I want that click to get going. So, you know, inevitably what happened for me is, you know, a common story we hear a lot in Crystal Meth Anonymous. I ran away from home at 16, ended up in Hollywood, California at 17. And I had been going to LA a lot as a kid. See, because my favorite thing is when I get high is I like to hitchhike. And whether I'm going north to Los Angeles or south to San Diego, it's a whole other community, you know? So I love it. I love the adventure of it. And what was happening for me, I was just doing a lot of car sex and transactional sex. It's part of my skills. And what happened for me, I went up to Hollywood. You know, I had met these gentlemen who were very kind. And a couple of them I had met in my parents' church. So my mom, my mother was going to counseling with the minister of our church with my dad. My dad was an alcoholic. So they went to counseling. Instead of going to AA, they went to counseling. So what happened in counseling is my mom ran away with the minister, and my dad took my twin brother and he split. So I kind of got lost in the shuffle, which was fine with me because I had big things to do. And so in that, you know, I would disappear. My mom would say, come to church with us, you know, come be the minister's daughter, you know, and inevitably I was a big disappointment. And but she introduced me to these gay guys who just showed me the nightclubs of West Hollywood, you know, sneaking me in at 15, 16 years old. And then they, you know, these couples would tire of me because I was a, you know, teenage alcoholic addict, and they wanted to do coke. And I thought coke was a bore. And so inevitably they would pass me on to another lovely couple, and they would, you know, so it was like this chess game. And I would go to Long Beach, LA, back to Orange County, Laguna, Long, I was just having a great time, lots of gifts. So so for me, when I finally made the decision to, I always say, move to Hollywood. No, I ran away to Hollywood, and this is a time when all the, now, kids, get it. This is when all the trade was out on the boulevard. Uh-huh. You had to find or procure sex. You had to be out driving your car. So, they were up on Selma. They pushed us all. The police pushed us all down to Santa Monica Boulevard. So Santa Monica Boulevard in the 80s, early 80s was a scandal. It was just a scandal. It was so much fun. So, and there were certain things. You know, you had to keep moving because you can't just, like, you know, prop your leg up and hold. You know, you had to keep moving. So, because you could get arrested if you're found loitering in the same location in a two-hour period, they can arrest you. So you had to keep it moving. So you would, I did the car wash circuit. So there was a car wash on, in West Hollywood at Palm in Santa Monica. Then I would head east down to La Brea in Santa Monica, which is now a Target, but used to be a car wash and a terrific taco stand. And get a little sustenance, but you had to keep moving there too because the girls were on that corner. And then if you run across the street of La Brea and Santa Monica to the other side, it was LA County. So you could avoid the police. And then I would head down to Gower in Santa Monica, right by Hollywood Forever Cemetery. So, and then you would cut up Lexington, which was a block up, and then do the whole Fruit Loop all over again. It was terrific time. So, like I said, I was just jumping in and out of cars. It was just pre-internet, pre-websites, you know, just a common tweaking hooker. And the thing was, it wasn't that I was attractive, I was just available, which seemed fine for most of these people. So the searching for meth, getting high, drinking, the whole life just kind of scooped me up. And I'll cut to, at the age of 18, I went to my first AA meeting because there was a boy that I just had it bad for. So he's like, you're a mess. You need to get help. So, which I thought was a lot of, you know, chutzpah on his part, because I would go out, turn a few tricks, come home to our apartment in West Hollywood, spell out I love you in crystal meth on the dining room table to prove my devotion. I know. It's a cautionary tale. So, you know, neediness is so unattractive. And it really is. So, when he told me I had to get sober, I tried to get sober. And so he ended up moving to Europe for a career, and I was in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I needed to be there. I knew I needed to be there, and the miracle of sobriety happened for me. So at 18 years old, I celebrated a year of sobriety and chose, after working all 12 steps, having commitments, being very visible in Alcoholics Anonymous in the West Hollywood area, I chose to treat my alcoholism with crystal meth one more time. So, I'll be back on Monday. I'll be back. What could it hurt, you know? So, that was on a Friday. So that Monday came 5 years later. Yeah. I lost all choice. I was in it. And once the genie was out of the bottle, I humanly could not choose to put her back in the bottle. But I was that queen that was collecting those chips, 30, 60, 90. You know, I could get those days physically sober, but I was unwilling to change my, truthfully, whorish behavior in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was rough. It was rough out there. So I'll just cut to that last year of, you know, drinking and using was up for 5 days, sleep for eight, up for two, sleep for four, you know. And what was happening was I was, you know how the body just kind of shuts down after like day eight or nine, and you just have to lay down. So all in the back alleys of Hollywood, California. You know, there have been times where I'd been just dumped out of a car into these alleys, you know. So I would come to, and it was like a bright Sunday morning, and it's bright. And no clothes on, you know, no clothes on. So I do see that I have, you know, shoes halfway down the alley, but nothing else. So I'm fashioning little outfits in newspapers with little, you know, pulling it all together, trying to come up with a look. So, and just walking to my friend David Chiriboga's house, who lived up on Fairfax. So I was just clicking along. And you know what you do, what happens on those Sunday mornings when you're still gacked out? You know, all those sober hags are toot-toot. Hi, girl, you okay? Hideous. Hideous. So I go crash on David's couch. I'd sleep for 4 days. And then all of a sudden, I've had a nap and a sandwich. I'm getting back out there. Gotta go get those coins. Brutal. So that 5 years of in and out was, it broke my spirit. It broke my spirit in a way because my head was telling me, they're talking about me. They hate me. I can't get this. I'm too broken. I'm too broken for the miracle of sobriety. And I was too chicken shit to kill myself, really. So for me, what took place is that the last week of my drinking and using, I had been with these clients, a lovely couple again, and we had been smoking meth for a week, and I had an idea to go borrow their car to run to the store because I was thirsty, and the car had been... a week and a half later, reported stolen, because people frown on you stealing their cars. So I was pulled over and taken to the Wilcox station in Hollywood, California, dressed in combat boots and a little Catholic school, high school skirt, little plaid skirt, on a Wednesday morning. And I had been there before for loitering charges, but now I was looking at serious trouble. You know, I was looking at, they, Queens are so touchy about their cars. Anyway, so, so for me, I, you know, they said, what are you gonna do? So I called the only number that I could remember at the time, which was my dealer. And my dealer came and bailed me out. And I slept on his couch for a week, woke up, and I didn't know if that would be my sober date. I didn't. I didn't trust that I was willing to join the No Matter What Club. And so what happened for me is I went to the first sponsor I ever had, Daryl. He was a saint, putting up with my nonsense when I was 18 years old for that year. And I went over to his house and, of course, you know, telling him how fabulous everything's been. I'm sorry you haven't seen me in 5 years, but I might need to go to one of those, you know, AA meetings. And he said, being a good AA, he said, absolutely. You know, I was 120 pounds. I was gray in complexion. I was bleeding from every orifice from my body. I had a collection of STDs that I seemed to not be able to get rid of. And he took me to a meeting that night. So that my sobriety date is November 13th, 1988. So... And I got busy again in Alcoholics Anonymous with the reserve, with that reserve of, I don't know if, I think I'm too broken to get this. I'm too broke, I've done the steps. I think I'm too broken, but I kept going to meetings. And so that was, it was the beginning of my journey. And I was running to a meeting to meet my sponsor at the time, who said to me, if you don't want people treating you like a hooker in the room, stop dressing like one. And he bought me an enormous overcoat, which I love, 1950s overcoat, because when I came into the rooms, I had two pairs of spandex tights, some tennis shoes, and some, you know, spaghetti strap tank tops. That was it. So, and it was November, December, it was getting cold in Los Angeles, so I got this coat, I loved this coat, and I was running up the stairs at this meeting to go take a, I think a 30 or a 60 day chip. So excited and so proud of myself. And the coat ripped. The coat caught on the railing and it ripped. And you had thought that somebody had killed my puppy. I was hysterical, hysterical. So he picks me up, he takes me in the other room, and he says, you either call the Van Ness Recovery House or you find another sponsor because I don't have the skills for this. Well, I'm like, whatever. So so I just want a side note, newcomers, side note. So that sponsor that I got on day one, a new sponsor, on day one, I had met roller skating that night after the meeting. And he was someone I was having sex with. And what happened was I'd been, because I was homeless, homeless, no address, homeless, I sensed he was gonna get rid of me after a couple weeks, so I asked him to be my sponsor. Complete manipulation. So, and I proceeded to manipulate sex from him for a good 3 or 4 months. So, poor thing, poor thing. Anyways, like, you know, using those skills. Skills. Some call it character defects. I, at the time, was calling it skills. So I hadn't done any work. I had not done any work. You know, and when I was getting, you know, years into my sobriety, I would tell that story. They're like, oh, that's horrible. That's horrible. That man would take advantage of you. I was like, no, no, no. All my part. All my part. I had done enough work at that time a few years later to realize it was my part. So, oh my God. So I went to treatment and it really gave me a solid foundation. really did. And so the thing was, is that what I learned in treatment, and certainly working with the guys that I sponsor, who, you know, some of them like to say, oh, I've been to eight programs. I've been to 10 programs, meaning rehabs, you know, and I'm like, those are treatment facilities. Those aren't the steps. That's the program. You know, I'm grateful for, you know, it being available for me to go to treatment and treatment facilities, you know, especially in Los Angeles, it's like every other block there's one. But the program is in the 12 steps, you know. So anyways, so I started getting busy and I had this friend, Bill Coffey, who would talk about, you know, there was only a handful of us talking about crystal meth because, like I said, it was the 80s, you know, it was all about, you know, the cocaine addicts had it so bad until we had the 90s when it was the heroin addicts who had thought they had it bad. And, you know, I just would share about what would happen for me. At the same time, I realized that by getting into the steps, that for the first time, I had no backdoor plan. In regards to my recovery. That if it meant me being in AA meetings at the time, this is pre, you know, Crystal Meth Anonymous, that if it meant being of service and being in the rooms of recovery for the rest of my life, the small little life, I was okay with that. Because crystal meth had just torn me up. It tore me up. I mean, for every bottom, there was another bottom. And, you know, out back then, for me, 1987, I had tested positive out there. They gave me an AIDS diagnosis for having less than 200 T cells, which was the standard practice at the time. I was going in and out. But what I was noticing is all those guys that I just loved seeing so much, you know, you'd go to a meeting and there'd be a row of people who had their seats who weren't there anymore. And so, you know, even with my HIV diagnosis back then, you know, it was the dark days of the AIDS epidemic. So I had a lot of fear about being, you know, 22 at the time when I tested positive, that my life was over. So if I was just going to be sober, that was great, because that family I'd run away from, they hadn't heard from me in years. So I'll just be sober. I'll just be sober. I'll make coffee for the rest of my short life. That was the goal. So I ended up getting a new sponsor about a year of sobriety. The same sponsor that I have today, Ralph B. And I loved this man so much. He really just grabbed me by the neck and got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous and has given me such sound advice. So this is someone that has helped me get to the truth quicker today. Because as he would say to me, you know what, Jeffrey, omitting, all this omitting you're doing, it may be 80% omitting, but it's 100% of a lie. So we have to get to the truth, because you struggle with relapse. You struggle with telling the truth. And I was like, okay, let's get busy. So I practiced. I learned how to be my authentic self, you know. It was really a surprise for me, because I only had two feelings. Everything was fine, smile, deflect. Everything's great, you know. Or I was in tears, I cried a lot my first year, all the time. I was just, I don't know if it was the detox in the rooms, or I was just crying all the time. And so, but I got busy here. And what happened for me is, about a year of sobriety, I met a boy, because there's always a boy. So this guy, Michael, had just gotten out of Folsom Prison. And what had gotten so uncomfortable rumblings. Okay. So he had gotten sober in prison at Folsom because of H&I. And so we just, you know, he was this East LA gang member, just adorable, covered in tattoos. And what he saw in this Nelly joyful queen, I have no idea, but we had such a great time together. We would go to meetings. We would, you know, we were just visible, going to meetings every day. And about 3 years into our relationship, he woke up one morning with toxoplasmosis on the brain. So half of his body was paralyzed. So I'm now 26, 27 years old, taking care of someone who's dying of AIDS, going to meetings every day and working and trying to work. I had to go get a real job. No, there's shame in that. I had to go get a job. You know, I had to go get a job. So, you know, but I couldn't stay stuck in the feelings because everybody was going through it. I couldn't be unique in it. Everybody was going through it. But what was remarkable is these people in recovery were like, every week we were taking meetings to people at home who couldn't get to meetings. You know, we'd go clean out apartments and contact family members, you know, remarkable. And what I learned from watching these people passing through the AIDS epidemic is the courageous sense of humor they had, because they had acceptance, things they had learned in recovery. They stayed sober no matter what. You know, how could I relapse on that bullshit? You know, so I was all in. And when, at the same time, side note, so that sponsor I got after a year, Ralph, said to me, "You get to dream big here, Jeffrey." I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? Everyone's dying. I'm just trying to keep our apartment. And he's like, no, you get to dream big here. And I was like, okay, I don't know what that dream is. I think I was talking to Val about that outside. And, you know, it's like, what is the dream? I'm a big, really big advocate of people getting dreams around here. You know, it says in our big book, it's the bridge program is the bridge back to the outside world. What do you want that world to look like? You know? So now that I'm doing all this stuff, I thought I was a hooker. Okay, what's the dream, you know? I thought I'll be a chorus boy. So I had never danced before in my life. Why not? I was gonna die anyways of the butt flu, you know? It's like all that stuff going on. So I would go take, yes, butt flu. Get a sense of humor about it, yeah. I had to. I mean, no offense, it just, you know, it's so funny. My friend Kathy put in her book, Butt Flu. She was like, Jeffrey, that's horrible. I was like, yeah, isn't it great? So I got busy. I would go take one dance class a week in between, you know, while Michael was passing, his mom would come and take care of him. And it was my dream. I'll go do dinner theater, I don't know. I'll go do something, you know, I didn't really care. I just was like, it gave me passion. I had something to, outside of AA and recovery and being of service and all this stuff going on, I had something for myself for that hour and a half, you know. And I was starting late, so I was like, oh, that's okay too, you know. I had to let go of what it's supposed to look like, the dream. So inevitably, I booked this show in Tucson, Arizona. And I'd been going to the Alano Club, which was basically an adobe hut downtown Tucson with like just bikers and waitresses and dogs fucking in the corner. It was just like crazy. It was so like this cast of characters. I didn't utter a word at all. I just would go to the noon meeting. Booked a show, Gypsy, with Betty Buckley. And it was my first professional job. And I was just thrilled. My boyfriend was like, my mom will take care of me. You just go do 8 weeks and come back. This is your time. You've been taking care of me for a couple years now. Go do something for yourself. So I did. I went to Tucson. I went to Tucson. So, and I went to meetings. That's what I did. I went to rehearsal. I went to meetings. I went to rehearsal. I went to meetings. You know, so I was 3 weeks, 4 weeks there, and Michael passed unexpectedly from a bacterial infection, and I was devastated. And for me, what happened was my friend Betty, she said, get in the car. So we went to the noon meeting. We went to the noon meeting, and they were like, oh, nice to see you guys. You know, that was it. And I raised my hand to share. And I was like, my name's Jeffrey, and I'm an alcoholic addict. And they were like, yeah, we've been wondering when you're gonna share here. And I just lost it. I just started crying. My boyfriend just died of AIDS. I have HIV. I am afraid. I don't know if I can get through this. You know, dramatic. So I sat there crying, and these people, you know, I think I was the only gay person in the meeting. It's Tucson. At noon. And they didn't care that I was this cocksucker from Hollywood, California. They did not care. A lot of them had not been exposed to knowing anybody that had HIV, let alone had died of AIDS. So this was all like new. And these people really just scooped me up. I came back to LA. Michael's family came in and cleaned out my apartment without my permission, which was very common back then. I was like, please just give me my dog back. You can keep all this stuff. And the rooms of recovery in West Hollywood, they just kind of carried me along. And I went back and finished the run of the show. And so those 2 weeks that I was doing the show, I was processing a lot of grief. But I loved going out to play on the stage. It was great. It was a distraction. And those people that I had met at that noon meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, that straight meeting, they were constantly bringing food to the stage door, leaving notes, hey, we're up late if you want to call us after your show. And I was like, oh my God, they don't know me. You know, I'm the thing they fear most, but they were good AAers. And that kindness and that service really just kind of jolted my recovery. Oh, this is what this is about, showing up for others, you know. So I came back to LA and I started the whole, you know, just my recovery, going to meetings. So like I said, my friend Bill Coffey back in 94 started the program of Crystal Meth Anonymous in Los Angeles. And it was great. It was great. It was so rough. It was rough. It was rough. Oh my God. Predatory, sketchy. It was, but the miracle of recovery was being spoken, you know? And much like AA, you know, 85 years ago, there was a lot of internal fighting and stuff. All of it I stayed out of, you know, I just had to. So, but I loved going to Crystal Meth Anonymous. And in the early days in Los Angeles, it was a lot. It was a lot of personalities. It was a lot of relapse. It was a lot of people falling in love at their first meeting and never seeing them again. And so, but it was great because all of a sudden I'm in a meeting where I can speak my own language and tell my own truth that I'm a crystal meth addict. You know, when I drink, I go after the meth. Then after a while, why waste your money on booze? Just go to the meth, you know? I like to click, gotta get going, you know? But the thing that I realize is that being on crystal meth from 13 to 23 is I was awake for all the shitty behavior that I did. Just snapshot, snapshot, snapshot of all of that. I didn't, you know, for me back then, you know, the psychosis would come like 3 or 4 days later. I didn't, you know, it's not like the stuff they're doing now where they're instantly into it. What a drag, you know? Oh my God. At least get a good run out of it, you know? Jeez. So. Cuckoo. So. So I, my journey here in my recovery has been, I'm sure you can sense is that I've been messy. I've been messy here. I've been messy. Newcomers, it's best to be messy in the rooms of recovery than a mess out there. Just stay. Just stay. Just stay. So, you know, I've had this, you know, I went from the hooker to the chorus boy. Okay, I'll do that for a while. I'd be going on the road. All of a sudden, all these things started happening. Dancing in New York, doing national tours, all these surprises. And I was like, oh, this is fabulous. Why not? When I was on the road, my favorite thing, they used to travel a bike on the truck so that I could go to meetings in the mornings while those chorus boys are out boozing and doing whatever, you know. I was out going to meetings at every major city in the United States. I loved it. I loved it. So eventually I did move to New York 20 years ago. And, you know, CMA then was new also. It was only a few years old. So that part of not doing G before the meeting had really, you know, taken hold. And... So I moved to New York. I wasn't, thank you. I wasn't a newcomer and I certainly wasn't young, you know, but I loved going to meetings and because that's what I know to do. And I met some really fantastic people. So I was doing this nude aerial act at Splash at the time. And all the bartenders at the time and the other performers, you know, eventually they all started making their way into the rooms of Crystal Meth Anonymous. And, you know, they were grateful to see me. They're like, how do you show up to work and not get high? And I was like, it's a discipline. I'm here for the surprise of this life. It's a surprise. I am still that enthusiastic, obnoxiously happy person. You know, my opinion, here it comes, is that grateful people don't get loaded. Great, you know, they don't. You don't hear about that newcomer saying, oh, I was so grateful, I had to go hit the pookie. You know, it's like, it doesn't relate like that. I think gratitude is an action. That joining the No Matter What Club is an action. So, and that in the last 34 years that, you know, I have armed myself with facts about myself. And I encourage you, especially if you're a newcomer, arm yourself with those facts. Get into the inventory process, you know, because my opinion is, here it comes, it's either the dick or the dollar that's gonna take you out again, you know. And that's just my opinion. That job that becomes too consuming, you know, because you're trying to climb that corporate ladder. Oh, I'll go to a meeting tomorrow. Oh, I'll go at the weekend, you know. Oh, I don't need sponsees. I'll call my sponsor later, you know. It's that thing. Or that piece of trade that's so undeniable that you're like, oh, you know. And... it happens. It happens. So it's like the guys that I sponsor, I spend a lot of time on the sex inventory, part of the inventory, because it gave me the greatest freedom. Freedom. Such a magical word. Freedom to navigate my sex contact. So during the pandemic, I was on a Zoom call with, or a Zoom meeting with Wyoffy was on there. And here's my opinion. See, I clarify, because a lot of stuff I'll say, you won't find in the big book, but here you go. So I said, honey, you could go fuck a giraffe if you want to, just don't hit the pipe. So Wyoffy chats me in this, and do you know there's this whole like community of what they call giraffes? So there are bears, and there are otters, and there are giraffes. You have to be 6'3", Wyoffy, and over, or they're not, yeah. Yeah. I was fascinated. And their admirers. And their admirers. So it's not completely exclusive, but they do meet like once a year or something. That'd be special things. Can you imagine? All over six. It starts at 6'3". That's wild. So if you needed more information, go see Waffy in the back and help the young. So anyway, so, you know, getting back to the sex inventory, so I found more, you know, the causes and conditions and my patterns, my selfishness, you know, those resentments, you know, all those things that you get to have a healthy sex life here. You don't have to go hook up with someone who's getting high. Thank you. That when I'm engaging in those extracurricular activities that, you know, I ask, do you get high? Do you get loaded? You know, I don't wait till I get there. No, find out. You know, it's unacceptable for me to go hook up with someone who's high. I don't care how beautiful they are, how, you know, enticing it is, or how damn needy I am that moment. You know, the gift of pause has kept me in good stead here. You know, I have enough armed information for myself. I am a warrior for my sobriety today. You know, because I do step work, because I'm current with my sponsor, because I get to the truth quicker. You know, those small things. And so, you know, you get to have freedom here. By showing up in this life for me, I get to be my authentic self. You know, the shame I had about being this Nelly cartwheeling little kid, you know, I just embraced it. I've done enough writing, putting pen to paper, step work, communication, conversations about who is Jeffrey today? You know, who is Jeffrey today? I've had relationships, you know, some 6-7 years. Oh, right, like I said earlier. So my boyfriend I came with last time, you know, and I am just saying this, he has found recovery again, but he got high. He got high. 1 week we're talking about getting a house together. You know, we had been together 6 years. It was the next thing. And he came home to say, I've been shooting meth. For me, this is just me, for me, if the house is on fire, I run out of the house. You know, there's no negotiating. Oh, baby, that's, I'm so sorry. No. Because even at 34 years, my friends, that I'm one bad decision. I'm not, time isn't a tool here. You know, so I have to be on guard for my recovery today. I am that warrior because just for me, it's too painful. You know, the last boyfriend let's get honest about this, Jeffrey. Okay, Christopher. Oh, wait, I have to finish that story about you. Anyway, so you know, I met this guy in recovery. He goes to my, I do a couple meetings down on 48th and Crenshaw, kind of South Central. Great, amazing CMA meetings. And I met this guy. anyways, you know, here it is, newcomers. If someone tells you from the podium of recovery that they love you, it doesn't mean you have to get into a relationship with them. So it was a surprise that I didn't expect. And, you know, we had a good run for about 6 months until he got loaded, you know, and it broke my heart. But I was like, okay, where do I take your stuff? You're not coming back here. It's just me. And so, you know, he's finding recovery in jail because I got the letter. because that's where I end up. That's me. You know what I mean? I have no judgment, but that was me. In and out of jail as a tweaker is not a good look for me today. It's not. I know that I can go out there and get loaded today. I do. I don't know that I'm guaranteed another recovery today. So there's no seatbelts on my chair at the meeting. I have to just hold on to it. Hold on to it. So I could do 20 minutes on disappointment in the last 34 years, but I could tell you about the blessings and the miracles that I have peace of mind today, that I have freedom, that I am my authentic self today. I am unapologetic to be a member of Crystal Method Anonymous today. Unapologetic. You know, it's just... Thank you. It's you guys. It's you guys. This is what I've done some crazy ass things in recovery, both good and bad, you know, but I'm here for the long haul. So like I said, it's better for me to be a mess in the rooms than out there being a mess. You know, I don't want to be a senior tweaker. I don't. Because the cruelness of my disease is I might have 20, 25 more years doing crystal meth. You know, I'm afraid of it. So I am that person that I have a passion and a joy for this recovery. I love it. I love doing the work, as painful as it is. I love the surprises that come along in a sober life. You know, I still have dreams that I get to dream big about. I hope that you find one this weekend. Just a little dream for yourself. Keep it close, you know, and do the work. Just do the work. The program is outlined. It's all in order. Take it in order. Find a higher power of your own design that works for you. You know, I was having a small nervous breakdown about 5 years of recovery. I was at a Starbucks and all of a sudden I heard the musical, this Overture to Gypsy. And I thought, what a perfect piece of music. And that was my higher power for a while. You know, and it's evolved because my life got bigger. My life got bigger and surprising. And, you know, so I went from being a hooker to a chorus boy. I work in casting today. I had a job. I've had this job for 16 years now. I had a friend. I have 5 more days than he does. And he called me and he's like, girl, I need an assistant to answer phones and set up appointments. And I thought, oh, great. I had just closed in a show in Boston. And so I came back to Los Angeles where I'd gotten sober. And I learned this whole new job. It was a surprise. You know, the road effortlessly presented itself. And I thought, oh, okay, I think I can do this. I love my job today. I love it so much. Again, all these aha moments, you know, it always comes back to my connection with my higher power and staying disciplined here. Every morning it's a gratitude list and it goes out to many of you. You know, I sponsor, how many?
16.
16 guys. But I'll say 10 of them are in the work. I can't chase, I can't give it to you. I can't give you willingness. I had to find it for myself, you know, but I was sharing at a meeting on Zoom about a year ago and this queen got on there and I was like, ugh. And she was like, Jeffrey Drew, you're a first responder with like this tone. And I didn't understand what it meant at all. I was like, oh, okay. And she could see my face because I was like, the chin went out and I was a little, And she's like, because you show up for people. And I was like, yeah, that's me. I'm a huge service person. Also during the pandemic that, you know, I was really, you know what it is? I'll be honest with you. So I'm this queen that will, if your location is on, I'll show up. If I know you're getting high. Yes, it's Gary there. It's Gary in there. It's Gary in there. You know, that's. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So that's what that queen meant. I'll show up. If I'm asked to be of service, the inconvenience, you know it's service when it's inconvenience, you know, but I do it anyway. I'm a happy camper here. I am a happy camper. If you're lacking willingness today, take a little of mine. I got plenty. If you're lacking a little joy, I got plenty. Take some of mine. I will give that to you. Please just stay. It isn't necessarily for yourself, but I need you. I can't do this alone. You know how crazy I am? You've listened to it, you know? It's like, but I'm here for the long haul. Thank you. I just want to say that this has been just a far out trip. I love being here. Thank you so much for asking me to speak. And that, you know, for a dollar in the basket, all your dreams can come true too. So stay, just stay.